Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington. Ahead, we hear about expanded U.S. assistance to fight ISIS. We speak with the AJC Berlin director about how Europe is responding to terrorism. The editor of the Almanac reveals some of what's in this year's edition.
A lot happened in entertainment this year. Obviously, you saw the Star Wars premiere.
And we take a look at that long-awaited new Star Wars film. It's right here on The Voice of America. The finance ministers of the governments on the UN Security Council are expected to adopt a draft resolution to impose sanctions aimed at disrupting the revenue streams flowing to the Islamic State. It will build on a previous resolution that targeted the Al-Qaeda terror network. With more on the fight against Islamic State is my colleague Victor Beatty, who joins me here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Hello, Susan. Well, in Baghdad Wednesday, the U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter offered Iraq expanded U.S. assistance to combat the IS group, which controls large parts of western and northern Iraq. Carter met separately with Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi and his Iraqi counterpart.
I had a very productive meeting with Prime Minister Abadi, and also separately a meeting with the defense minister, and discussed with them once again the desire of the United States and its other coalition partners to accelerate progress, the kind of progress that the Iraqi forces are exhibiting in Ramadi. The United States is willing to do more in association to support the Iraqi security forces in that mission. I emphasized that to Prime Minister Abadi. I also emphasized to him that I was working with other coalition partners to get them to up their contributions.
Carter, who encouraged Iraq to retake both Ramadi and the northern city of Mosul, has told U.S. lawmakers that Washington is prepared to provide advisors and attack helicopters to bolster Iraqi efforts to recapture Ramadi, the Anbar provincial capital, which fell to IS fighters in May. He also announced plans to deploy an elite force that will attack IS targets in both Iraq and Syria. It's encouraging news to Ambassador James Jeffrey, who served in posts in both Iraq and Turkey and is now with the Washington Institute for Near East Affairs. He spoke with me earlier.
Anything we can do to increase the speed with which we take territory from ISIS is very good news. We're running into resistance from the Iraqi government, not because Abadi is opposed, but because Iran is doing everything in its power to stymie any cooperation between the Iraqi government and the U.S., even if that means letting ISIS hold on to places like Ramadi. I mean, it's absolutely infuriating. And on one hand, the Iranians say that they want to cooperate with us on ISIS, and on the other, this is what we see happens. Nonetheless, what Carter is doing is really good. I think the president really understands, our president, that he has to start producing real results on ISIS. He has not up till now.
What should be the strategy going forward, sir?
To seize terrain and defeat ISIS using all elements of American power, including, if necessary, some American ground troops to prime the pump so that we get good ground troops from other countries. We can go in from Turkey. We can go in from Kurdistan. We can do this quietly. We can do it more openly. But we have to start taking territory from these people. That has to be the bottom line. The means have to be adjusted to the ends, not the ends to the means. And essentially, that's what we've been doing up to now, adjusting the ends to the means. The president didn't want boots on the ground. He didn't want casualties, either ours or civilian casualties. He didn't really want to get involved in fighting a war. And you see what's happened after 18 months of supposedly fighting a war against ISIS.
How's the battle going to retake Ramadi?
It's going very slowly. Some reasons for that are very understandable. We want to avoid civilian casualties. Another is it's a conglomeration of Iraqi forces. But one good news is that a lot of Sunni Arabs are in the fight on our side. And then finally, the Shia parties, again with Iranian support, have been trying to slow the thing down.
In a related story, the U.S. said it's withdrawing a dozen warplanes from the Incirlik Air Base in Turkey just a month after they arrived. The Pentagon says no big deal. They were on a short-term mission. What say you, sir?
This is really curious. These were F-15s. Some of them were dual use, but most of them were air superiority fighters, and we put them in after the Russians flew their aircraft into Latakia, obviously, so that we would have the ability to escort our own fighters and, frankly, to respond to any Turkish requests to defend NATO territory. Why we're withdrawing them at this time is a kind of curious thing in this campaign, Victor, that the administration hasn't explained why. They didn't have to explain why they were sent, because we all could figure that out. We all would realize that maybe we wouldn't want to provoke Putin by saying we're flying them in so if necessary they can shoot down Russian airplanes. That I get. But why are we taking them out?
A Pentagon spokesman said the deployment was always intended to be temporary, and the decision does not lessen U.S. combat capability in the region and comes amid fresh commitments made by France, Britain, and Germany. A dozen U.S. warplanes, along with unmanned drones, still remain at the Turkish air base at Incirlik, as well as other warplanes from members of the U.S.-led coalition.
Thank you for that report, Victor.
All right, Susan.
On social media concerning the ISIS problem, John Betts at John from Cranbrook tweets, Obama's failure to leave a residual force in Iraq allowed for the rise of ISIS. Whether we should have invaded in 2003 is irrelevant. Business Insider reads, Italy's prime minister has announced that the country will send 450 soldiers to protect Iraq's most important dam, the local reports. Fox News says the front line with ISIS isn't just in Iraq and Syria. It's also in Kennedy Airport and the Rio Grande. Also trending today is tensions in Baltimore after a mistrial was declared in the Freddie Gray case. Fox News quotes the hashtag Freddie Gray family attorney Billy Murphy as saying, I don't think either side won or lost. There are plenty of articles and photos about the trial at hashtag Freddie Gray. Also a hot topic, the new Star Wars movie. We'll have more on that a little later in our program. And the Golden State Warriors. NBA.com says the 2015 NBA champion Golden State Warriors garnered more than 1 billion social impressions during the month of November as the team was in the process of establishing a new NBA record for most consecutive wins to begin a season. It was the first time that the club surpassed 1 billion impressions in a calendar month during the NBA's regular season. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Have you ever watched a dog or cat drink water and wonder how they are able to quench their thirst from what appears to be some rather sloppy and haphazard actions? Well, it turns out that the parched poochies and kitties know exactly what they're doing. And according to a new study, they're actually executing some rather precise and high-speed movements that allow them to get needed fluids. Dogs and cats each have their own unique drinking methods. As dogs lap up the water, they're actually moving their tongues very quickly to overcome the water's inertia and force it up into their mouths. Cats use a much smoother action and merely skim the surface of the water. Cats and dogs have had to develop these unique methods since neither of them are able to create suction to help them drink, like humans and other animals such as elephants and horses. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Following the terrorist attacks in Paris, Europe is on high alert for more violence. Deidre Berger is the Berlin director of the American Jewish Committee and is now visiting the United States. She joins us on the line from Philadelphia. Welcome, Deidre.
Thank you. Glad to be here in Philly.
How do you perceive how Europe is responding to this threat of terrorism?
Europe is confused. Europe is divided. There's not a cohesive response at the moment to the terrorism threat. There are different situations in different countries, but above all, there needs to be better coordination. The European Union has just appointed a central coordinator for sharing of intelligence, Gerhard Conrad, who's negotiated numerous spy exchanges, including between Israel and Palestine, but there has not as yet been the degree of cooperation that I think many in Europe would like to see, and that's important. There was a breakthrough recently where there was an agreement to share in more detail passenger records. This has been somewhat disputed for some time, but the threat, the very current threat and the impressions of the horrible shootings and killings November 13th in Paris, I think, are bringing Europe together and accelerating the fight against terrorism.
Are the Muslims facing severe discrimination as a result of these terrorist acts?
There is, of course, resentment, anxieties about Muslims in general due to these terrorist acts. It happens anywhere in the world. I don't think this is special to Europe. but it's a problem for some. But I think there also, on the other hand, needs to be more recognition within Muslim communities of the importance of speaking out and distancing themselves from acts of terrorism. The Muslim community is not well organized in Europe, by and large. These are individual groups of people. They may go to individual mosques, but there are not very strong umbrella organizations with spokespeople who can speak out on these issues. I think that this has caused additional problems because there aren't partners in the community for governments to the degree they would like to have them within the Muslim community. There is, of course, discrimination in Europe on many levels. Religion is one factor. People are also discriminated against because of socioeconomic status, because of skin color. There's racism. There are many issues. But I think important to know is with this wave of terrorism, many of the young attackers in Paris came from relatively stable backgrounds, even middle class. This is not just a problem of poor, deprived people rising up and turning to terrorism. It's a much more complex problem, these sympathies with extremist movements at the moment.
What about the threat posed by accepting refugees from Syria that may actually be members of ISIS? It's very controversial here in the States, where we recently had a terror attack involving a migrant from Pakistan.
There is a certain risk, there's no doubt about it, particularly because in Europe, there's really not the opportunity at the moment to extensively screen the backgrounds of those who are pouring in. There's simply too many refugees. In Germany alone, 965,000 refugees have come through the end of November. Hundreds of thousands have yet to even be documented because the offices are running around the clock and they still can't process all the applications at the moment. So, of course, there's a danger that ISIS and other terrorist groups are using the gaps in the system at the moment. However, it's almost not necessary. The larger issue is homegrown terrorism, as we saw from the attacks in Paris and other attacks that we've had in Brussels and Toulouse. These were not disaffected Syrian refugees. These were young people, French, Belgians, who grew up in the heart of Europe and have turned to terrorism. This is the much larger threat. Of course, there's concern about the incoming refugees, that they will be prey and to the Salafists, to the extremist movements. But let's remember, most of these refugees are fleeing extremism. Many of them are persecuted minorities. They're Kurds, they're Yazidis, they're Christians. I think that the real danger is in Europe waking up to the fact that there's terrorism in its midst, as we just saw in the United States with San Bernardino. This is a much larger global fight against terrorism and extremism, and it needs much greater resources than we've allocated to it presently.
Well, thank you very much, Deirdre, and I hope you enjoy your trip to the United States.
Thank you so much.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
Coming up on International Edition, thumbing through this year's World Almanac, and may the force be with you. The World Almanac and Book of Facts 2016 is out, and joining us to talk about what is in this edition is Senior Editor Sarah Jansen. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Hey, maybe you might start off by sharing with our listeners just what the World Almanac is all about.
Well, the World Almanac has been around since 1868, so we've actually changed a lot over the course of our nearly 150-year history. But basically what we're about these days is providing your best go-to reference source for any question you might have, whether it's on politics or pop culture or science or sports. We've got you covered.
It's a reference book, basically.
Basically.
What are some of the major events of 2015?
Well, I think it would be no surprise to find out that our top news topic in 2015 was the ongoing civil war and conflict with ISIS in Iraq and Syria, obviously something that's going to be spilling into 2016. And then that's related to our number two top news topic, which was the refugee crisis. Almost a million refugees and migrants have reached Europe by boat or by sea in 2015, which is an enormous number. And that's, again, going to be something that we're going to be looking at in 2016 as well.
What about from the world of entertainment?
A lot happened in entertainment this year. Obviously, you saw the Star Wars premiere. That'll be interesting to see how that does numbers-wise as it tries to take down Avatar as the number one top-grossing film of all time. Adele's first record in a long time came out. You also saw the transition in Late Night with Stephen Colbert taking over for David Letterman. So a lot happened in 2015, for sure.
And what about sports?
Oh, gosh, it was a busy year in sports, too. I think one of the highlights for us was watching the U.S. women's national team take the World Cup this summer, the highest-rated World Cup of all time, which was really fun. You also saw the first Triple Crown winner in almost 40 years, an American Pharoah. You had Deflategate distracting everyone all year. Serena Williams trying to do that calendar Grand Slam. A lot of interesting events in sports this year.
And you haven't mentioned politics.
Well, we were paying attention to politics all year. Maybe everyone's a little bit tired of hearing about it, but we do have a really great election preview that includes things like primary dates, debate dates, also an overview of what's going on in the election, including financial information about all those many, many, many different campaigns, including information on how the super PACs are doing, since that's how a lot of campaigns are being funded these days.
Now, you have things organized a little differently this year. Please tell us when we go out and buy one of your almanacs, how do we go about researching it?
Well, it depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking to answer a specific question, it's the same as any other reference book. You can use the table of contents or the index. But I think a lot of people like to just flip through it and land on a page. And really, if you're a generally curious person, you might just find something that you would have no interest in necessarily looking up yourself, but you kind of you get hooked by the new information, by the fun that's available in the World Almanac.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? It's called Swift Key Symbols. It's an Android app with a picture-based keyboard that makes it easier for kids with autism to express themselves. The app lets users construct sentences by picking an image from several categories, such as people, actions, and colors, then predicts and suggests other words to continue the sentence.
Want Friday, tomorrow, Saturday, toy car.
So you want to play with your toy car.
This new technology is being used at Riverside School in London, where nearly two-thirds of the 220 pupils have autism. Charlotte Parkhouse is the school's language therapist.
To see our pupils use this app and suddenly they discover the joy of interaction between themselves, between themselves and adults, is really wonderful.
The Swift Key company in London has not announced a launch date for this app, which they say is still in the very early stages of testing. VOA's What's New. I'm Todd Grossons.
The latest installment in the Star Wars saga, Star Wars: The Force Awakens, has opened in Los Angeles. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the long-awaited film is living up to the anticipation and offers fans a new story for a new generation.
A who's who of Hollywood turned out for the premiere in Los Angeles Monday night. Star Wars: The Force Awakens takes up the story 30 years after the end of The Return of the Jedi. The galaxy is still at war between the forces of the First Order, an offshoot of the old Galactic Empire, and the Resistance, the next generation of the old Rebel Alliance. The film features many of the heroes from the saga, including Han Solo, Leia Organa, Chewbacca, R2-D2, and C-3PO. Anthony Daniels, who plays the protocol droid C-3PO, said Monday that director J.J. Abrams has produced a film that a new generation of fans will fall in love with.
Because the care and attention, the love, the detail, everything, the enthusiasm, the excitement that JJ and the whole team brought to it, and the cast, it's being echoed tonight.
Harrison Ford reprises his role as smuggler and rebel fighter Han Solo. He said it was great to be back in the old role.
You know, people have been anticipating this film for a long time, and that's a good thing. And we had a really good script, and JJ is a director that I really admire and have for a long, long time. I was pleased to be back.
Adam Driver plays the new villain in the series, Kylo Ren, who has sworn to take revenge on the rebels for destroying the Empire. Driver says the magnitude of his role didn't hit him until he got on set.
It really didn't hit me, actually, until I walked into this guy's office, who's Michael Kaplan, who did the costumes for it, and I saw everybody's drawing on the wall, and that was the first time that it really hit me. Oh, it's a Star Wars movie.
John Boyega plays Finn, a stormtrooper who finds his loyalties divided between the First Order and the Resistance. Boyega says that being part of the iconic series is mind-boggling.
Yeah, I feel great. I feel fantastic, and I feel surprisingly relaxed. I mean, this is an environment that I feel like is loving enough. I'm a Star Wars fan, so I feel like we're paying homage to a film that I really respect, so I feel good.
Star Wars The Force Awakens also stars Oscar winner Lupita Nyong'o. Daisy Ridley plays Rai, a scavenger who gets drawn into the conflict. Mark Hamill reprises his role of Luke Skywalker, the Jedi Master, and Carrie Fisher returns as Leia. Game of Thrones star Gwendolyn Christie stars as Captain Phasma, the first female stormtrooper.
I just feel like Lucasfilm and Disney have listened to what people want, and in being more diverse at the casting choices and creating characters like Captain Phasma, I think they've really listened to what it is people want to see on their screens.
Star Wars The Force Awakens opens in wide release in the United States Friday. It is the first of four new Star Wars movies due out by 2019. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Even as the world marks the 67th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, China continues to crack down on rights defenders and others who seek to peacefully question official policy and contribute to the public discourse on China's future. Since July, the Chinese government has detained nearly 300 lawyers and activists. The United States has called for the release of more than 20 such people who remain in custody, as well as Ilham Tati, Ken Pokartsi, Zhong Kai, Gao Yu, and Liu Xiaobo. Rights lawyer Pu Jicheng, who was arrested following his participation in a private meeting to peacefully mark the 25th anniversary of the violent suppression of the Tiananmen Square protests, is currently on trial. He stands accused of making criminal comments online, inciting ethnic hatred, and picking quarrels and provoking troubles. Pu Jicheng has been detained since May 2014. The United States mission to the United Nations recently expressed concern with China's national security law, noting that it codifies an expansive and vague definition of national security that invites arbitrary and situational interpretation by security forces. In addition, the United States is also concerned that the government's draft foreign non-governmental management law would unreasonably constrict civil society and undermine people-to-people exchange. It is incumbent on China to uphold the rights enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Marking the 67th anniversary of this important document on December 10th, President Barack Obama said, "We will continue to lift up the lives of all who yearn to exercise their inherent human rights and to shine a light on those still living in the darkest pockets of our world."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.